Thank you very much for that introduction, Alistair. Just to begin, I would like to acknowledge some of my predecessors, once I can get this thing working. This appears to be off, is it? Thank you. Right, I would like to not begin just yet. Thanks. Yeah. It seems that I'm the 12th Mintec-affiliated SAIMEM president, and that dates back just over 100 years to the time of G.H. Stanley. It includes Dennis Maxwell, Dave Howlett, Robbie Robinson, Peter Jochens, Kim Atmore, Peter King, Henry James, Nick Boxer, Rams Romachopa, Andre Garbus Craig, and finally, here I stand before you today. Somewhat in awe of this impressive array of people who've been affiliated with Mintec or its predecessor organizations over many, many years. I've had the privilege of working with all but two of those people. Certainly don't date back to 1914 or 15, and I missed out one somewhere in the middle as well. But apart from that, I had the privilege of working with most of them. My topic tonight is truth and error in scientific publishing. And I think it's quite clear from a quick cursory inspection of the news media that there are a number of scientific issues that are facing us at the moment. For example, some current controversies such as climate change are quite difficult to know just where to find the truth. There's certainly a lot of evidence that shows that climate is changing. It's less clear, perhaps, to some that change is in the direction of warming the globe. It's also questioned by some, perhaps on shaky grounds, that man has played a significant part in climate change. But how do we go about establishing the truth of the various claims that are made, and how do we interpret where they are coming from? Another area that affects all of us is the dietary guidelines that we've been given as to how to balance the amounts of protein and fats and carbohydrates that we eat. And certainly some of the conventional wisdom has been based on appalling science. But there are many claims and counterclaims doing the rounds at the moment. And where does the truth lie, and how do you judge how to live your life and feed yourself? Now, all of these topics rely on scientific evidence to get closer to the truth. Scientific progress relies on the publication of ideas and experimental results that can be replicated and tested and improved over time. Now, a lot of people have spoken over the years about the subject of truth and knowledge, which has to be the beginning of a talk like this. For example, Socrates says that the wisest of men is he who knows that he knows nothing. Aristotle says that all men by nature desire knowledge. René Descartes said, if you would be a real seeker after truth, it is necessary that at least once in your life you doubt as far as possible all things. Galileo said that all truths are easy to understand once they are discovered. The point is to discover them. He also said, in questions of science, the authority of 1,000 is not worth the humble reasoning of a single individual, and then went on to demonstrate just that. Arthur Schopenhauer said that all truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. Third, it is accepted as being self-evident. Now, this whole notion of truth being something out there to be discovered is something that Newton spoke about as an undiscovered ocean of truth. He said, I do not know what I may appear to the world, but to myself I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself in now and then, finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me. Now, in philosophy, the branch of study of knowledge is known as epistemology, and we're going to have to touch on that, and I'll try and make that a brief digression, but I think it is important just to establish the foundations of what it is that we're trying to understand tonight. knowledge is often defined as justified true belief. So it has to be something that you believe. It has to have a sound basis, a true, the objective truth, and needs to be arrived at via a process of reasoning. In other words, it must be justified, not merely a lucky guess. Now, knowledge of the truth can be obtained in two broad ways. One, by a priori reasoning, for example, in mathematics or logic, or by empirical experience, the broader fields of science, engineering, etc. Now, Albert Einstein spoke about epistemology and said that science without epistemology is, insofar as it is thinkable at all, primitive and muddled. However, no sooner has the epistemologist who is seeking a clear system fought his way through such a system than he is inclined to interpret the thought content of science in the sense of his system and to reject whatever doesn't fit into it. The scientist, however, cannot afford to carry his striving for epistemological systematic that far. He therefore must appear to the systematic epistemologist as an unscrupulous opportunist. So, with that mouthful behind us, I think we're going to indulge in some more unscrupulous opportunism as we go into the more scientific side of things. But first, we have to look at various isms in describing truth. And many people see truth in different ways. On the one extreme, you get the people who follow solipsism. I don't know any of them personally, but I can have some sympathy with the approach. This is the absolute denial of reality. So we're not all sitting in this room at this moment. Perhaps this is just a collective illusion. It is a possibility. One has to entertain it. One notch lower than that is radical skepticism, which says that we can only truly have knowledge of our senses. Anything else is indirect. Then you come to the relativists, where everything depends on your point of view. Now, this is something that goes back quite a long way. Marcus Aurelius said, "Everything that we hear is an opinion, not a fact. Everything we see is a perspective, not the truth." Then you get those who are more pragmatic and follow instrumentalism, where they say, yes, quantities can be measured, even if we have no way of knowing whether theoretical entities actually exist. Thermodynamics actually employs this quite effectively. Then you have fallibilism, which says that you can know things, even though we are sometimes wrong in the things that we mistake. Then you have empiricism, which is based on observation or experience. Now we're getting really closer to the central approach of science. Then you have rationalism, which is the other type of truth based on reason. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have those who follow dogmatism, who are very certain of their truth. Oliver Wendell Holmes said that certitude is not the test of certainty. So to study truth, we need to go back in history quite a long way, a very long way, in fact, to the ancient Greeks. Ancient, that means before they joined the European Union, where Socrates lived from 469 to 399 BC. Now, he introduced a method of teaching that involved asking questions. And this great philosopher, Socrates, did not even record his own words for posterity. But fortunately, Plato recorded the teachings of Socrates in many of his books. And it's often said that all of philosophy following Plato is actually just a variation on the theme that he introduced right at the beginning. The Socratic method led to the development of the scientific method in due course. Others also played a part in developing the scientific method. For example, Karl Popper, now this is moving forward, just fast forwarding a few thousand years, where Popper introduced the notion of falsification and falsifiability as being central to the enterprise of science, where it's, you know, if you use the classical example of the statement, the scientific statement of all swans are white, and you see one swan, two swans, three swans, they all happen to be white. So far, you haven't proved that that statement is true. But that one black swan that you see can absolutely prove that that statement is incorrect. So that falsifiable statement is a scientifically testable statement, and that is the way in which we need to phrase scientific questions. And then also seek the attitude of deliberately trying to prove wrong all of the things that we hold true and closest to us. So go out and test things. If they are true, they will be true. And if they are not, well, it was a good thing to test it anyway. And the process of science involves observation, hypothesis formulation, and testing. Thomas Kuhn also introduced some new ways of looking at the scientific method, describing it as scientific revolutions by paradigm shifts. So, for example, in the biological sciences, things changed dramatically after Darwin. In sociology, in economics, in politics, things changed dramatically after Karl Marx came along, as they did in physics after Albert Einstein and his relativity. So, the sort of simple outline of the scientific method, I guess, would be to say that observations of the world lead to the recognition of patterns through inductive reasoning, like the swans example, which lead to interesting questions about why this pattern might occur. Hypotheses are formed in such a way that they are framed as testable questions. The scientific method cannot be applied to things that you can't test or you can't falsify in any way. So then you find a number of possible explanations and think up ways of testing which ones might be wrong. You then go and gather data and repeat that process many times to test the prediction. The hypothesis is then either rejected or accepted or, more likely, refined and retested. Experiments should be replicated reproducibly. And where appropriate, it's necessary to use control groups or, for example, in the medical or pharmaceutical field, double-blind protocols where both the person being experimented on and the experimenter don't know exactly what is happening in the experiment. If two ideas explain the data equally well, the simpler one is preferred. Occam's razor suggests that the simpler theory with fewer or less onerous unproved assumptions is probably the most appropriate one. General theories then gather together the hypotheses that are consistent with all the current data. But even at the end of that long process, these theories remain provisional and tentative until something better comes along. And so scientific theories cannot be proven, they can only be corroborated, but can be shown to be beyond reasonable doubt. I will confidently stand here right now and say that the sun will rise tomorrow. But I don't mean to imply by that it will rise 10 billion years from now, by which time its fuel will most likely have been exhausted. So there is a time frame validity to some of these questions of truth as well. But let's go back again to ancient history, to what I would almost term the Silicon Valley of the ancient world, the Library of Alexandria in Egypt this time. Now, as in Silicon Valley in California, you have the heart of the technology of today being computers. Back then, the technology, the cutting edge, was papyrus production. And papyrus production was centered around Alexandria. So it was natural that a large library was built up there from about 280 BC to a few hundred years later when it was all tragically destroyed. But because it was this world-renowned center, it attracted many people from around the ancient world. As it was the center of collected knowledge, scholars such as Euclid and Archimedes are said to have written, studied, and experimented there. Let's fast forward again another few hundred years, this time to the mid-1500s, where the tradition of scientific and technical literature in the field of metallurgy started this long time ago. Della Pirotecnia by Vinocchio Biringuccio was the first printed book on metallurgy to have been published in Europe. It was written in Italian and published in Venice in 1540. It provided details on mining practice, the extraction and refining of numerous metals, and the production of alloys such as brass. At a similar time period, Georgius Agricola, who lived at that time, wrote a book that roughly translates to of things metallic or on the nature of metals, this De Re Metallica. Agricola travelled extensively and wrote about mining methods and metallurgical processes that were in place in the Middle Ages. The original Latin version was published in 1556, the year after Agricola died. The English version of De Re Metallica was published in 1912. It was translated into English by Herbert Hoover, who was a mining engineer as well as perhaps being slightly better known as President of the United States, and his wife Lou Henry Hoover, who was a geologist and classicist. Agricola said, "I have omitted all those things which I have not myself seen, or have not read or heard of, from persons upon whom I can rely. That which I have neither seen nor carefully considered after reading or hearing of, I have not written about." Pretty good basis for a good book. Moving on again a few hundred years to a very important milestone that we're celebrating this year in scientific publishing. Scientific publishing of journal papers has been in existence for 350 years this year. The first issue of Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society was published under the guidance of Henry Oldenburg. This is the world's oldest and longest running scientific journal, and it was first published in March 1665 in London. Henry Oldenburg, the secretary of the Royal Society and the first editor of the publication, ensured that it was licensed by the Council of the Society, being first reviewed by some of the members of the same, thus making it the first ever reviewed journal. The Royal Society announced in October 2011 that they had made the historical archives of the Philosophical Transactions, that's over 60,000 scientific papers, permanently free to online access from anywhere in the world. All of the historical archival papers published more than 70 years ago from the Philosophical Transactions are now freely available on their website. And it's quite a privilege and a pleasure to go and see the original published work of people like Newton, read Benjamin Franklin's account of how he tested lightning by holding a kite in a thunderstorm. Crazy, but he survived to tell the tale. The current publications of the Philosophical Transactions are available, just delayed by a short period, that differs for biological sciences and physical sciences, are also made freely available by the Royal Society. And that takes us quite neatly to the time of the founding of this institute. The early days of scientific societies involved regular meetings that were held to discuss science and to run experiments. So typically an evening like this, instead of covering a wide range of topics, would have one paper being read and discussed, some experiments, some interactive discussions, all of that painstakingly documented. Quite a lovely pace at which to live your life, I would imagine. The reading of scientific papers took place, and many discussions were held, and these often included rather robust debate. The picture below shows Nikola Tesla giving a demonstration in 1893. I don't have any of the actual meetings of SAIMM and its predecessors, which started a year later, but I thought this would kind of set the scene for what it might have looked like. So some notes from the very first edition of the journal of, at that time, the Chemical and Metallurgical Society of South Africa from 1894. The President's inaugural address by William Bettel said, "As chemists and metallurgists of the Rand, you have before you much useful and interesting work, and it remains with you, gentlemen, by publication or diffusion of accurate scientific information, by exposure of pseudo-scientific frauds, to claim as a right the recognition of your proper status in relation to this community. I heard a rumor about a certain company getting an actual extraction of 125% from concentrates. Such results, as I have instanced, are obviously imagined, or as chemists say, cooked." So many things do not change over a long time. So here we are tonight, still talking about truth and error. Some of the robust discussions from 1 year later, 1895, again, rather politely but directly said by William Bettel, our first president, "As for Mr. Suckling's process, I fail to see the novelty or usefulness of the method. The use of a blast, pressure, instead of a draft of air, suction, is to my mind a retrograde movement and absurd from its manifest conditions." And Mr. Schlunde in the monthly meeting in May of 1895 said, "I have examined the Suhlmann process from both theoretical and practical points of view, and I can only come to the conclusion that it is not a bromination process, neither is it a cyanide process, but that it is a very bad oxidation process, consequently useless." I long to read comments like that today. But in today's world, there's a plethora of publications, and it's close to impossible for anyone to keep up with such a vast flow of information. So instead today we have international conferences with hundreds of presentations taking the place of this local meeting that used to discuss a single paper or experiment. And in this frenetic environment, it's essential that researchers are able to trust the material that they read. Learned societies nowadays exist to promote an academic discipline or profession, and are mostly not-for-profit organizations. They typically hold conferences for the presentation and discussion of new research results and publish or sponsor academic journals in their discipline. The system of peer review, significantly flawed but the best we have, and more of that later, is used to maintain standards and to improve the quality of papers. Some learned societies continue to publish journals themselves, while others have contracted this job to commercial publishing companies. SAIMM is fortunate to be in control of their own destiny in this regard. In recent times, the internet and the World Wide Web that was devised by Tim Berners-Lee have transformed the dissemination of knowledge, a capacity once exclusive to publishers. Google's previous CEO, Eric Schmidt, said, "Between the birth of the world and 2003, there were 5 exabytes of information created. We now create 5 exabytes every 2 days. This is fair to describe that as an information explosion. Recent developments in electronic publishing on websites make it possible to disseminate information more widely and cost-effectively than before. And professional societies have an opportunity to serve their members and their industry by publishing high-quality peer-reviewed papers on their websites as well as in printed form. Older publications can be scanned and optical character recognition can be used to provide searchable text to really get the benefits of electronic publishing today. Science has grown exponentially since the late 1600s in the time of the Philosophical Transactions founding, both in terms of the number of researchers and the publications. It's estimated that the size of science has increased by an estimated 5 orders of magnitude. That's 100,000 times greater than it was then. We can now say that about 80 to 90% of all scientists that have ever lived are alive now. That's quite a thought. An estimated 1.35 million scientific journal papers were published in almost 24,000 refereed journals in 2006. A current estimate for today is that perhaps there are about 2 million papers per year now. The total number of active scholarly journals, that's refereed plus non-refereed, is over 60,000. There were nearly 2,700 open access scholarly journals, including just over 1,700 that were also refereed. Amongst those 1,700 is the SAIMM's own journal. The Public Library of Science, or PLOS One, which is a paid open access journal, published 6,749 papers in 2010, making it the world's largest journal published exclusively online. Another major changing factor has been over 30 years, where in 1983, China produced just 0.6% of the articles that were surveyed by Thomson Reuters. But 30 years later, by 2013, China produced some 13% of the literature, second only to the share of the United States, which is 29%. Now, the style of a journal paper is very typical and standard. It always has a title, a list of authors, their affiliations, and an abstract. Now, this is a very short abstract. The title, "Can Apparent Superluminal Neutrino Speeds Be Explained as a Quantum Weak Measurement?" Abstract, probably not. I enjoyed that too. But amongst these 2 million papers a year, what happens to them? And it's very interesting to me that citations are actually quite rare. A study of over 1.3 million papers across all disciplines and years found that 61% of papers had zero citations. 12% had only one citation, with a small 4% having 16 or more citations. Another independent study found that 55% of papers are not cited at all. Yet another study showed that this varies quite significantly across disciplines. So citations of journal papers are most common in biological and physical sciences, less so in engineering, where not only journal papers are used, but conferences are more important, and where implementation is often more important than publication. Social sciences tend to place greater reliance on books than on journals. So whereas you might get round about 50% of uncited papers in the primary sciences, that figure may be up to about 70% for engineering remain uncited, and above 80% in the social sciences remain never cited by anybody. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights says, or includes these words, "Everyone has the right freely to share in scientific advancements and its benefits." Now, I'm an actively strong proponent of what is known as open access, and would like to speak about that for a few minutes, as to how that provides the means for the realization of that particular aspect of the Declaration of Human Rights. And here I want to draw an important distinction between the work that scholars want to give away, in other words, journal articles, conference papers, that they expect no payment for, and the work from which they do expect to derive income, such as if you've spent 2 years of your life writing a book, you clearly expect to be paid for that. And so this present discussion focuses only on the first group. In academic publishing, authors are not paid by the journal for their writing. Peer reviewers give their time voluntarily to evaluate papers and suggest improvements. Journal editorial boards and sometimes even the journal editors are unpaid. However, scientific papers can be very costly for readers to obtain, typically tens of dollars per paper. Something is wrong with that picture, I believe. Especially now with the advent of low-cost publishing on websites that has changed the cost structure of information publication and dissemination, making it possible to extend the reach of this information to a much greater worldwide audience. Online publishing allows articles to be made available much sooner than printed versions, and there is considerable support for the idea of a more open research literature that is accessible to all. And open access publishing aims to provide universal, unrestricted, free access to full-text scholarly materials via the internet. And this is different from the traditional approach of publishers that regulate access by means of subscriptions and license fees levied on users and academic libraries. The principle of open access publishing is to maximize the ease with which you can obtain publications. And this has a number of advantages. Open publications are visible to search engines such as Google, making them easily found. And this serves the best interests of authors in that they want their writing to have maximum reach and impact, especially in terms of what we said about a lot of work lying uncited, and want their work to be discussed and cited often. It also serves the interests of readers who desire low cost or free access to a wide range of information. Peer reviewers are also usually authors and readers, so their interests are looked after too. However, it's very important to safeguard the interests of publishers or scientific societies, as these bodies have high reputations and ensure the trustworthiness of what is published. So, what are the sources of funding that you can change this entire model of publishing? They could include membership fees, subscriptions to journals, sale of publications, sponsorship, limited advertising, conference fees, article processing charges, and very importantly, subsidies from funding agencies. And if this is properly managed, it is possible to maintain the same standards of high-quality production of peer-reviewed papers with the potential of greatly increased dissemination and citation. The high cost of obtaining published papers can be seen as a barrier for scientists and engineers working in the poorer countries of the developing world, as well as for unemployed scientists who would like to keep abreast of their fields while seeking work. And open access provides unrestricted availability to anyone with a connection to the internet. Another advantage is that search engines can be used to find associations between items that would be missed by human readers of individual papers. And in so doing, reinventing the wheel can sometimes be avoided. Now, today's world faces many policy choices, including issues such as climate change, energy generation, recycling. Now, these issues cannot be properly addressed without widespread access, even by the general public, to the results of scientific research in each of these areas. We're living in an exciting time where a lot of political changes are happening in terms of open access to publications. The British government recently announced an initiative to make all taxpayer-funded research available online to anyone who wants to read or use it. From 2014, just last year, the results of all research funded by the European Union must be open access. In February 2013, the US White House announced that government-funded research should be made free to read within 12 months of publication. Current estimates of the proportion of papers available free online range from 30 to 50%. Just a few years ago, when I last investigated this, the figure was under 20%. Things are changing, and I believe in the right direction. And it's very hard to argue that keeping scientific information behind expensive paywalls is in the best interest of society. There's an increasing degree of dissatisfaction in the scientific community that the big three publishing houses, Elsevier, Springer, and Wiley, own most of the world's more than 20,000 academic journals and account for about 42% of all journal articles published, pretty close to a monopoly. Commercial publishers are clearly concerned about losing their revenue stream to open access competition, and there is some skepticism about the economic viability of the open access model of publishing, but these objections are often easily overcome. And I think the world has moved on in terms of that argument now. It's also been argued that there is a moral imperative to remove restrictions of access to the scientific literature. And a fundamental question that needs to be addressed by learned societies is, are they there to make a lot of money from publishing, as is the case in a number of especially American societies, or are they there to use their other sources of funds to underwrite publishing, or the other way around? So it's in the best interests of all to ensure open access to a searchable and freely available literature. And this is done via means of a number of variants of the open access model. SARMM's journal was first published in 1894 and is currently published monthly. It's published electronically as well, with papers in PDF format. Old papers, initially from 1969 as a fairly arbitrary cutoff, were scanned and subjected to optical character recognition to make them searchable and placed online. All of the previously unscanned historical copies of the journal, right from the outset, the 1894 period, up to the 1969 cutoff, were recently digitized with the support of the Carnegie Foundation as part of their effort to get a wide range of African journals online and through the support of Sabinet. When these journal papers were initially made available on the SAIMM website quite a long time ago, they were available free to members, but at a cost to members of the public. But in 2007, SAIMM made the decision, a progressive decision at the time, and I believe a right one, that all journal and conference papers were to be made free of charge to everyone. And this has become a key part of our publishing strategy. because what we're wanting to do is disseminate scientific and technical information to the benefit of the mining and metallurgical industries. And we also want to provide the widest possible readership for authors who publish in our journal. SIMM also makes its papers available to other online databases to extend the reach even further. And these include the International One Mine database of societies like ours from around the world, as well as the Cielo system that is managed by the Academy of Science of South Africa. We publish proceedings of many mining and metallurgical conferences, and the cost of these of the publication of these proceedings is covered by the conference fees, and the conference papers are made available online via open access a short period after the conference has taken place. But clearly, SIMM has real costs. It does cost money to put this whole publishing chain together, and these funds have to be covered from somewhere. And in our case, that is done by advertising and sponsorship, which covers many of these costs. But of course, the principal sources of income, as you've heard tonight, are actually membership subscriptions and conference fees. The Pyrometallurgy Division at Mintec started in about 1996 to make available all of its open publications, papers and patents on its website. In order to make the initial selection of older papers available, the question of existing copyright restrictions had to be addressed. In some cases, this was easy. SIMM was very happy to say, of course, with pleasure, you can use our papers. Others, not so much. But over time, many scholarly publishers, including Elsevier, Springer, and Wiley, now include concessions in their copyright policies to allow some form of self-archiving of the full-text articles, either in institutional repositories or on personal websites. We're now going to touch on the error side of the picture. Here it said, don't believe everything you read on the internet, and that may or may not have been said by Abraham Lincoln as depicted here. One of the classic comparisons of the online versus the printed approach to the literature is often the comparison between Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica. Very interestingly, in 2005, Nature magazine published a study of the accuracy of articles from these two sources, and this showed that the difference in accuracy was not particularly great. It averaged out to about 2.9 mistakes per article for Britannica and 3.9 for Wikipedia. Now, Britannica bases their model on strong scholarship, sound judgment, disciplined editorial review, lots of permanent staff, whereas Wikipedia is very current. If something happens around the world, by that evening, there will be something, somebody has written an article on the subject, which is wonderful. It's comprehensive in its coverage, and it's based on continuous correction by many people. A very different approach, but very in keeping with the scientific method. So the core Wikipedia values include a neutral point of view, no original research to be included, only secondary reportage, as is appropriate for an encyclopedia, verifiable information only, and a citation of all sources. Another thing I would like to introduce to you is Stigler's law of eponymy. And this says, in its strongest form, no scientific discovery is named after its original discoverer. Now, this is named after a University of Chicago statistics professor, Stephen Stigler, for his 1980 publication. And in essence, the reasoning behind this approach is that the historical acclaim for discoveries is often assigned to persons of note who bring attention to an idea that is not yet widely known, whether or not that person was its original inventor. How widespread is this, do you think? Well, Alzheimer's disease has been previously described by at least half a dozen others before Alzheimer's 1906 report, which is often wrongly regarded as the first description of the disorder. In the metallurgical world, the Bessemer process was discovered by Kelly in 1851. Henry Bessemer only obtained a patent on the same process in 1855. Fibonacci was not the first to discover the famous sequence of Fibonacci numbers. They had existed in Indian mathematics since 200 BC, whereas Fibonacci provided his series in 1202 AD. The normal or Gaussian distribution was introduced by Abraham de Moivre in 1733, but was named after Carl Friedrich Gauss, who began using it in 1794. Even Newton is not immune to this. Newton's first and second laws of mechanics were known and proposed in separate ways by Galileo, Hooke, and Huygens before Newton described these in his Principia Mathematica. Newton owns the discovery of only the third one. The Reynolds number in fluid mechanics was introduced by George Stokes, but is named after Osborne Reynolds, who popularized its use. But perhaps Stokes got his revenge because Stokes' theorem was actually discovered by Lord Kelvin. But just to make it even more ironic, Stigler named the sociologist Robert K. Merton as the discoverer of Stigler's law, so making this law subject to itself. Robert Merton described the principle behind this law in his 1957 presidential address to the American Sociological Society, and touched on a number of interesting subjects that are relevant to us tonight. He talks a lot about the structure of the scientific enterprise and the pressure that is placed on scientists with regard to priority in scientific discovery. And this can go to the extreme. There was a great deal of controversy between Newton and Leibniz over the invention of calculus, effectively yet another one of many examples where an idea whose time has come springs up in more than one place independently. However, when the Royal Society finally established a committee to adjudicate the rival claims to priority in the invention of calculus, Newton, who was at that time president of the Royal Society, he packed the committee, helped direct its activities. He anonymously wrote the preface for the second published report. A bit crazy, as the draft was in his own handwriting, it should have pointed to him pretty directly. And then included in that preface a disarming reference to the old legal maxim that no one is a proper witness for himself. Now, Newton must have felt intense pressure for self-vindication that made him adopt such offensive means for the defense of his otherwise valid claims. And it was not because Newton was so weak, according to Merton, but because the institutionalized values were so strong towards priority of the claim that he was driven to such lengths. Quite extreme. But there's even more blatant fraud than that Merton talks about. He talks about the remarkably prolific Vrain Lucas, who in the mid-1800s created and sold more than 27,000 pieces of manuscript that included letters by Pontius Pilate, Mary Magdalene, the resurrected Lazarus, Ovid, Luther, Dante, Shakespeare, Galileo, Pascal, and Newton, all written on paper and in modern French. Most provocative among these documents was the correspondence purported to be between Pascal and the then 11-year-old Newton, all in French, of course, although even at the advanced age of 31, Newton could barely struggle through French, only with the aid of a dictionary. But these letters made it plain that Pascal, not Newton, had, to the greater glory of France, first discovered the law of gravitation, a momentous correction of history, which for several years excited the interest of the Academy of Sciences in France and usurped many majors of the Comptus Rendus, until in 1869, Vrain Lucas was finally brought to book and sentenced to 2 years in prison. Another famous hoax is that of the Piltdown Man. Now, this was an infamous paleoanthropological hoax in 1912, in which bone fragments, parts of skull and jawbone, were presented as the fossilized remains of a previously unknown early human. These fragments were said to have been collected from a gravel pit at Piltdown in East Sussex in England by one Charles Dawson. And the significance of this specimen remained controversial for about 40 years until it was exposed in 1953 as a forgery, consisting of the lower jawbone of an orangutan deliberately combined with the cranium of a fully developed modern human. Plagiarism is another plague on science. Here we have an example, a very recent one, an article from 2014 entitled "Development of a Guideline to Approach Plagiarism in Indian Scenario." This article was retracted by the editors of the Indian Journal of Dermatology this year, as large portions of the manuscript were copied from the first round questionnaire of a dissertation by somebody else. But this brings us to the subject of peer review, of which we've briefly touched. The system of peer review is used for two things. It's used to maintain the standards of the literature, as well as to improve the quality of papers. But this vital system is significantly flawed. There is little incentive for reviewers to invest sufficient time in picking up all errors in publications, and any mistakes on their part is usually protected by anonymity. It's reached the point where some reviewers have mistakenly permitted the publication of hoax papers deliberately presented with a complicated scientific facade. In light of such terrible inadequacies, perhaps we need to consider a more open review process. People have proposed signing reviews at the end of a paper saying, "This paper was reviewed by so-and-so." Perhaps that would make people a little bit more responsible in this very important task of peer review. But essentially, peer reviewers are not paid. They're not adequately rewarded for what is ultimately very hard work, nor are they held accountable in any way by having to sign their name to their reviews. The process of peer review is costly and time-consuming. It's also resistant to new or controversial ideas. Very often they get squashed by reviewers. And the suggestion has been made that reviewers should simply concentrate only on two questions. Is it true and is it new? And leave the other judgments to posterity and future citations. The agreement between referees is often little higher than by chance. Review is also vulnerable to misconduct, plagiarism, and breach of confidentiality. Some of the most cited papers of all times were rejected by referees. And these are only the ones that people were persistent enough to continue doggedly on until they eventually did get published. Many, of course, died along the way. They didn't get that far. So some papers that were initially rejected, or at least had delayed recognition through bad peer review, included the discovery of blood typing, Jenner's 1796 paper describing vaccinations against smallpox, the paper describing the Krebs cycle, the work on quarks, and at least 35 articles that would eventually earn the Nobel Prize for their authors were rejected outright during the initial inspection by reviewers. As one example, on the subject of quasicrystals, there was a paper rejected by the Journal of Applied Physics in 1984, but through persistence it was later published in Metallurgical Transactions A and Physical Review Letters. One of the reviewers, Linus Pauling, said, "There is no such thing as quasi-crystals, only quasi-scientists." Nevertheless, Dan Shechtman won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 2011 for his work on quasi-crystals. Even more damaging reviews than those. The 19th century physicist, Waterston, his classic paper on molecular velocity having been rejected by the Royal Society as nothing but nonsense, became hopelessly discouraged and left science altogether. Another example of somebody really well known was Mendel, who was deeply disappointed by the lack of response to his historic papers on heredity, and Mendel then refused to publish the now permanently lost results of his further research. After becoming abbot of his monastery, he gave up his research on heredity. Even worse, Robert Mayer, tormented by refusals to grant him priority for the principle of conservation of energy, fundamental to science, tried a suicide leap from a third-story window and succeeded only in breaking his legs and being straitjacketed for a time in an asylum. Clearly, the consequences of poor peer review are serious. Perhaps less serious, but still troubling, are some examples I've come across in the last year. In my own area of research, that of electric arc furnaces, one of the important equations that we work with is one by Ben Bowman that describes the shape of electric arcs. very important equation that's used in developing a whole lot of modeling techniques to describe these plasma arcs. Now, to my knowledge, Ben Bowman has published this equation twice in the literature, once in a paper in 1994, where unfortunately the brackets and the 1 minus just inexplicably disappeared in the typesetting process and nobody picked it up. So when a book was published by him in 2009, I thought, maybe this will rectify the problem. Sadly, no. This time, a squared term inexplicably crept in. But fortunately, one of my more vigilant colleagues who's here with us tonight was actually able to look at the published equation and spot where it was wrong, and so the correct version does actually appear here as well. Another area that's of interest to me is that of modeling the chemistry inside furnaces. One of the particular things is the cobalt oxide activity coefficient. I came across one paper that provided some very interesting looking graphs, which I thought that would actually be very useful to the work that I was doing. And they described that work with the equation presented on the screen here. Perhaps it was fortuitous that it was numbered 13, I don't know. But when I substituted numbers into this equation, which was already slightly in the wrong form, it didn't make sense to me. This equation should have calculated the activity coefficient of cobalt oxide in liquid slag as a function of the oxygen partial pressure. And at a temperature of 1400 degrees Celsius, the activity coefficient shown in the graph is about 10, but the equation has the wrong form and shows about 96 million as the answer. I engaged in correspondence with the author in Japan, and all I got back was a reply that said, "You are right. This equation is not correct. I made a serious mistake. Please, never use this equation." One of the practical things that I intend to implement going forwards is how to correct the recognition of mistakes that are made in published papers. Very often in a journal, 3 months later, you'll see in small print somewhere errata listed for a particular paper, and a mistake is pointed out, and there's no obvious way of linking that mistake to the original publication. And I believe that electronic publishing allows this link to be made. And it's a very simple thing. When the error is made, you simply publish the erratum as an additional page in the same paper on the electronic website. And I think this is a very easy way of preventing the current situation where errors tend to be propagated and they change, they transmogrify from one paper to the next. So a slip of a transposition of numerals or an incorrect, just a simple typing mistake, tends to be picked up and then replicated in subsequent papers. In order to test this process of peer review, there have been a number of experiments that are worth recounting as well. One of the very well-known ones is known as the Sokol hoax. Alan Sokol is professor of physics at New York University, published a hoax article in a journal called Social Text. And this is a journal of postmodern cultural studies in 1996. And he tried to really pick holes in this tendency to borrow scientific terminology in sociology to legitimize some very loose and woolly thinking. And so he wrote a paper called Transgressing the Boundaries Towards the Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity. And he wanted to see if the journal would publish an article that liberally salted with nonsense but sounded good but flattered the editor's ideological preconceptions. The paper proposed, among other things, that quantum gravity is a social and linguistic construct, whatever that means. The paper was published, it slipped through the system, and it then went on to spark quite a debate about the scholarly merit of humanistic commentary about these physical sciences. But this isn't really what Sokol was trying to achieve. He was just trying to say that actually, get real, guys. It's almost impossible to function in the world without some functional sense of truth. And this idea of trying to make it all relative and squishy by legitimizing with scientific concepts just didn't wash for him at all. And it really reminded me of the description of two worlds that was written by C.P. Snow, who once suggested the second law of thermodynamics would be a good test of scientific literacy for the humanist, and said it was about the scientific equivalent of, have you read a work of Shakespeare's? It's important to have an understanding of both the softer sciences and the harder sciences if one is to really pretend to try and understand the world. Another example of much more extensive hoax, I guess, is Bohannon's test of peer review. In 2013, John Bohannon, who's a journalist for the journal called Science, submitted almost identical fake papers, obviously and seriously flawed, to 304 supposedly peer-reviewed journals. And he followed a very similar template for all of the papers that said molecule X from lichen species Y inhibits the growth of cancer cell Z. And the authors and the affiliations in each paper were unique but fake. 157 of those journals accepted the papers, 98 rejected them. Some accepting journals were even published by major publishers like Elsevier, but the predatory paid open access journals fared the worst. Bohannon published an article entitled Who's Afraid of Peer Review in Science in October 2013. This study made quite an impact, although it was actually seriously flawed as well, and people very quickly interpreted it in the wrong way, latching onto the very poor practices of the paid open access journals largely, instead of realizing that actually this is a flaw of peer review, not of just the paid model of publishing. So how do we stop these things? How do we measure them? Well, a lot of the work that was done back in 1955 by Eugene Garfield set the scene for citation indexing. So it was really when computers became available and it became practical to get lists of publications and lists of all of the citations or references at the end of each article, link them all together, and then try and get some useful statistics out of that. Now, of course, there are many different ways of ranking the scientific output of a researcher. Probably the crudest one, which was used in years gone by, was simply the number of publications. So if you've done well, you've published a lot of papers, very well done. Unfortunately, that incentivizes people to break down their papers into least publishable units instead of more sensible groupings of topics. So not a good move. The journal impact factor was something else that Eugene Garfield worked on, and also has its flaws. I'll cover that in a few moments. Then maybe a slightly more sophisticated approach is to say, well, let the worth of a paper be dictated by the peers who actually cite that article. So the number of citations indicates the worth of a researcher. Now, again, that's too crude, because you as a co-author on a Nobel Prize-winning paper might have that paper cited 500 times and none of your other papers in your rest of your career get cited. So number of publications on its own is clearly not enough. You can go one step more sophisticated than that. You can look at the number of citations per paper, but still it doesn't adequately de-skew that distortion that could very easily occur if you happen to co-publish or have one flash-in-the-pan success and nothing else. Then what is probably the most widely used today is the H index, which we'll cover in more detail. But first, the journal impact factor. Eugene Garfield first introduced this concept of an impact factor in 1955 when he was director of the Institute for Scientific Information, ISI, now part of Thomson Reuters. Now, it's quite interesting that they index about 70% of refereed scientific journal papers, even though less than 39% of refereed journals are indexed. So this means more than 15,000 refereed journals are simply not indexed by them at all, and yet it still provides some very interesting statistics. The ratio of the number of citations that are made in the current year to the items published in the previous 2 years, to the total number of articles published in the same 2 years is what the journal impact factor is. Let's give an example. So the journal impact factor for SIMM's journal for 2014 is the number of citations that were made in that year, 2014, to all the papers, articles that were published in the two preceding years, 2012 and 2013. So that's the total number of citations divided by the total number of articles published in that same period. So it's meant to give you a sense of how many citations, on average, your journal papers receive. But unfortunately, this can't be used to meaningfully compare journals in different fields. Journals in biology receive orders of magnitude more citations than those in engineering, just as one example. So this is widely criticized for use as a lazy proxy for the quality of a particular paper. If you're wanting to know what the quality of a paper is, read it, judge it. Don't use this to substitute for the hard work. The intrinsic merit of a paper is much more important than where it is published as well. Don't say just because it was published in a highly rated journal that it has any more value than the same paper published anywhere else. It's an interesting phenomenon because people chase, are driven to chase the recognition that comes from publishing in high-ranking journals, that publication in high-ranking journals are more likely to be fraudulent than articles in lower-ranking journals, objectively measured fact. They also present discoveries which are less reliable because of the temptation to inflate your claims in order to get them accepted into a high-prestige journal. And some of the sociological mechanisms behind these correlations have been well documented, such as this pressure to publish, and preferably with positive results, and preferably in high-ranking journals. And this leads to the potential for decreased ethical standards. But one of the most widely used factors today is known as the H-index, which was proposed in 2005 by George Hirsch, a physics professor at the University of California, San Diego. And this tries to measure both the number of citations and the number of papers. So it tries to take into account two different dimensions, the measure of impact and the quantity of scientific output, and rate that as a single number. So the H stands either for Hirsch or highly cited. And he defines the H index as the maximum number of an author's papers that have been cited at least H times. Again, that might take a few moments to get your head around. So let's put it in simple terms. Having an H index of 15 means that a scientist has published 15 papers that each had at least 15 citations. So this avoids the problems that I'd mentioned earlier where the total number of papers does not indicate the quality of scientific publications, whereas citation counts can be disproportionately affected by a single publication of major influence. And this is a useful comparison between authors within a specific subject area. So again, don't compare a biologist with an engineer. It doesn't work. Also, don't compare a young scientist who's just started with somebody at the end of their career. But on a like-for-like basis, it's a good measure of productivity. So practically, what you do is you take each of your publications, count the number of citations that each of them has received, rank them in order from the highest down to the lowest, plot them on a curve, and then find the intersection of that 45-degree line with that curve, or you could just simply count them. It works just the same way. And that indicates your H index. So, for example, Google Scholar, available to anybody. You can go and have a look at yourself if you've published and linked onto it. But let's use Albert Einstein as a better example. And his H index is quoted by this Google Scholar H index as 105. So he has 105 publications that have been cited more than 105 times. Very impressive. Google tries to use something known as the PageRank to do something similar but even more sophisticated. And they rank the importance of a document in a search according to the networked importance of the pages that link to it. In other words, they say, if this paper has been, if this document has been referred to by another important document, then that makes it, it confers some of its importance onto itself. And so they take this on a network basis and come up with this page ranking facility. I love the play on the name of Larry Page and the page rank algorithm. Obviously the two founders of Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. I'd like to come to the end of this long and rambling talk across many centuries and across many disciplines by giving a mathematical example, which I think is rather quite a bit of fun. And this is something that's used in fraud detection, both in an accounting sense and in a publication sense. It's something that I only recently became aware of. Perhaps some of you know of it already. But if you don't, maybe you'll enjoy it like I did. Imagine having a list of randomly occurring measurements. So for example, get a list of the most highly populated towns in the world and take their altitude. Then look at those numbers, looking only at the leftmost digit. What do you think the frequency distribution of that leftmost digit, which clearly can only be 1 to 9, 0 would just disappear. What do you think it would look like? Do you think it would be evenly distributed at about 1/9 or 11% each? You'd be wrong if you thought that. In fact, it looks something like that, exponentially decaying. Surprising until you think about this very, very deeply, which we will do. Oops, sorry. Now, another very interesting feature of Benford's law is that for distributions that this applies to, the pattern of distribution of the leftmost digit remains the same even if you change the units. So if you express the altitudes as feet, as meters, even as Egyptian cubits, which is about half a meter, it doesn't change the distribution of the numbers. It changes the numbers themselves dramatically, of course, but the distribution, the pattern, you can see, remains essentially the same. This same pattern occurs with many other data sources, such as stock market volume, distances to stars, and some examples of real-life data are plotted here, and you see they all follow this exponentially decaying distribution. Very, very interesting. But why? But first, a digression. Simon Newcomb, who was a Canadian mathematician, noticed that when using his book of log tables, that really dates him and people like me who've used log tables before, but he noted that in the book of log tables in his library, the earlier pages, which contained numbers that start with one, were much more worn than the other pages. A strange finding. So he documented this discovery in 1881. The physicist Frank Benford rediscovered this observation in 1938, and as a great example of Stigler's law, it's named after him as Benford's law. So Benford's law is very useful in the detection of fraudulent data because most purveyors of fraud aren't aware of this strange pattern. So they go for the even distribution of first digits and can be picked up very, very easily in a number of cases. But if you're puzzled as to why that one is so much more prevalent than another, it really comes out of a number of mathematical things, including the central limit theorem and many others, of any distribution that's made up of anything that's multiplied or that's taken from a series of different distributions all at the same time. So let's just imagine a plant growing. And if it was to double in its length every day, you can imagine going from unit number one, it started off at 1.0, it had a whole day of being 1 point something until it doubled after the first day and it reached 2.0. If it's doubling in the next day, it got to 3 quite a lot faster than it got between 1 and 2, and so on and so on. And you can see that it follows a logarithmic scale. And if you plot the time that it takes in each of those growth periods, you can see that the cumulative distribution, or the sum of the distributions, across all of those different decades adds up to this particular distribution where one is favored, then two, then three, all the way down to nine. And it's a dramatic difference between an even distribution running at 11% to go from number one being 30% to number nine being less than 5%. So it's a fascinating thing. The maths is there for anybody who finds this as entertaining as I do, but it has great utility in detecting frauds. And it just closes the circle of the story to say that the advent of computers and electronic publishing and computing and mathematics all come together to hopefully, going forward, find better ways of getting closer and closer to the truth. So scientific publishing remains alive and well, despite some problems and challenges. Electronic technology provides some wonderful opportunities to improve the way we communicate scientific results. And the approaches here outlined should help us to get closer to this truth. I thank you.